Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. On today's show, director Anne Shin talks about her documentary, My Enemy, My Brother, and you'll hear from Toronto punk rock family band, that is right, the father and two sons, The Discarded. That's all coming up on today's show. My first guest is Anne Shin, who is the director of the documentary My Enemy, My Brother. And it's a story so unbelievable, it's hard to fathom that it's true. My Enemy, My Brother tells the real life story of two former enemies from the Iran-Iraq War who become blood brothers for life. Najah and Zahed meet in Vancouver 30 years after Zahed, who was an Iranian child soldier in the Iran-Iraq conflict of the 80s, saves Najah, who was wounded on the Iraqi side, fighting for the Iraq army, and they now embark on an emotional journey, back to Iran and Iraq for the first time in 20 years. Najah to look for his long-lost wife and son, and Zahed to try to meet his sick father for the last time. It takes them into the heart of the present-day conflict in a region ravaged by war and ISIS. In addition to My Enemy, My Brother, the screening that happened in Toronto was also accompanied by a 30-minute free VR experience called The Eye of the Beholder, which is set in a conflict zone and in which players encounter another soldier in a bunker who may be a friend or a foe. And it's a teaser for a longer VR game that will be released later in the year. It was a very emotional journey to be on while watching the film. And I got to speak with director Anne Shin from down in Austin, where she was at South by Southwest, to talk about this sort of four-year journey that she was on. Here is me and Anne Shin. Anne Shin, hello, welcome. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me on.
I understand you are in Austin right now.
Yes, yeah, at South by Southwest.
How was that experience treating you? That's always, I know that can be a bit daunting for any filmmaker.
Yes, it's a huge conference. There's, you know, thousands of things going on each day, and even their newsletter is it's like a tome. You have to decipher it to get through to what you might be interested in going to. I've got to hit some food trucks. I haven't had my kimchi fry fix yet, but it's nice to be down here. It's you know, lots of people around, and it's warmer than Toronto.
Austin's great for food. Is that always something you look forward to whenever you're out on the road? Is food, culture, music, whatever is part of whatever given city?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I love to get kind of delve into whatever is the thing in that city. So, and it's often food, you know. And so in Austin, I always want to try and hit up, get a barbecue place in and a couple of food trucks. We were just in Geneva at the UN Human Rights Council with My Enemy and My Brother last week, and had Swiss fondue. Of course, even though I'm like, I can't eat gluten and I can't digest dairy so well, but like, yeah, the fondue was really good. The people were nice too.
So let's talk about My Enemy, My Brother. This is quite a remarkable story between Najah and Zahed. How did you first become aware of them and the connection and their story?
A friend of mine, a radio producer at CBC, Greg Kelly, told me about their story, Najah and Zahed's. He had seen an article on it, and he said, I should do a documentary about it. And I looked them up. They lived in Vancouver, and I found their phone numbers and such, and went out to meet them. So I was talking with them, and they said, sure, we're happy to meet you and speak with you about it. And Neja agreed to meet me at his house. So I met Neja and Zahid at his house, which is in New Westminster or Richmond. And it was full of used goods because he buys and sells stuff at the flea market. So we're sitting in and amongst toasters and old snowboards and toolkits. And we sat down for 4 hours. I heard their story on the first day I met them. And afterwards, I was just bawling. And I was like, oh my goodness, this, your story is just so inspiring. I'd like to follow you as you continue looking for your wife and son. And that's how it all started.
And another interesting thing is that with this film, there's also a 30-minute VR experience that users sort of can experience what it's like to be in a war zone. Where did the idea to sort of include that as a side project for this come from?
Everyone is always, the idea for that project came from what's really the heart of the film, which is that moment when Zahid in the battlefield decided not to kill the enemy soldier, which is what he was tasked to do, but instead risk his own life and save him. And so I've always considered that question, you know, if you were in the same shoes, would you have had the courage to do the same? And I thought, you know, we're all faced with that decision in our daily lives. You know, if you meet a stranger on the subway, are you going to be distrustful and suspicious of them, or are you going to be generous-hearted and open to them? You know, are you going to help a stranger? And most of the time, we make that snap judgment just by appearance. And I was thinking about how we really do, particularly, you know, in the last few years with the refugee migrant crisis and such, there's been a bit of a backlash about others coming into our countries and migrants or refugee claimants. And I wanted to kind of think about that moment where you meet a stranger. Are you going to trust them and be open and generous-hearted or not? And depending on how you act on it, it's gonna have its own repercussions. They're gonna react back in a certain way depending on how you've acted to them. So the VR experience focuses on that moment. We set it in a conflict zone. It's unclear where it is. It could be anywhere, but it takes you through a situation. You're in a bunker. You don't know who you're with or who you're meeting. And depending on whether you trust or distrust them, whether you combat or collaborate with them, it determines who gets out alive, what happens to you both.
What would you say? I mean, we've seen a lot of talk about the migrant crisis in recent years, especially, you know, with the rise of ISIS, Daesh from that part of the world. But what would you say the biggest misconception is about political refugees, especially from that part of the world?
Yeah, I think the biggest misconception about political refugees from Middle Eastern countries is that they pose a threat. I think that's a huge misconception. And the idea that, you know, they need to be screened more vigorously or more rigorous, you know, standards be applied to them particularly is discriminatory. I think, of course, all refugee claimants should be screened, but, you know, particularly with, you know, Trump's administration, there's been a huge kind of bias against refugee claimants coming from the Middle East. So, I mean, that's a big misconception. The other thing is, A lot of the people coming are like from Afghanistan or Syria or Iraq or all these other places. They've had middle class lifestyles till very recently. They drove cars, they had jobs, they were in creative fields. You know, they had families, they had assets, and they lost that because of conflict. So there's a lot that we have in common with each of these people. But when we see them in a refugee camp or applying for refugee status, we think, oh, they're vagrants, or, you know, and it's just a huge misconception.
Yeah, I think it's Naja said something that really stuck with me throughout the film, and he says, Iraq is the country of the dead. You know, because it's basically been war-torn for almost the last 40 years. Did you learn anything about the country's history over that time period, and why it constantly seems to be unwillingly the center of conflict?
Yeah. The history of conflict in Iraq goes back decades. Even the Iran-Iraq War, which started in 1982, there was Soviet involvement and American involvement, as well as French and British involvement. And then after that, there was constant involvement in the air with the Gulf Wars, with American and Allied involvements at different times, and Canadian involvement too. There's been international interest in keeping unrest in that region because of the petroleum resources there, and it's an oversight to not consider our own responsibility for the destruction and the unrest that's been going on in Iraq and in surrounding areas.
As other countries, you know, like there was a big uproar when Canada got involved in Afghanistan, for example. When there's a conflict between two other, like two countries in that region, do we have a right or an obligation to get involved, or do we have a right or obligation to leave those countries alone and let them sort it out themselves?
That's a huge question, really huge question, an important one. I don't feel I can rightly say, because so many things have gone wrong when international countries get involved in supporting leaders or regimes, you know, and it's a huge question that I have no answer for. I'm curious, what do you think about that?
I mean, yeah, I feel I agree with you, because there are so many other factors that aren't on the surface that I think people don't realize. You know, like, I remember when, you know, Iraq fell in 2006 to Saddam, I had many friends that were saying, you know, Saddam deserved to be removed. And that's true. But does that make us right to be the ones who go in there and remove him? Like, you know, so yeah, I just think there's, especially in that part of the world, there is so much information that we don't know. And I personally would err on the side of getting more information first rather than less. But we are also living in the least violent time in our history as well. So I do think that's a positive.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the other thing too is like, their historical antecedents, even before America got involved, Britain was in there and dividing up the region. So there was, you know, imperial forces in causing distress and disruption within communities from, you know, early on in the 20th century and before. So it's hard to say, you know, when did foreign intervention start, and how, you know, when does our responsibility begin as, you know, foreign countries getting involved in that area?
But it strikes me, I think Najah alluded to it, and I remember watching The Daily Show a few years ago, in that in a way, America in that region is almost fighting a proxy war with themselves. And I think in terms of something that's not talked about, what do we need to learn about the history of that conflict and how we had an impact on creating the modern-day Iraq, the modern-day Middle East?
I think you're very right in bringing that up, because we do have a big impact. We have, particularly America, but there's Canadian involvement too, in creating this modern day situation where communities like Basra, Iraq, are worse off than they were 40 years ago. Like, you know, 40 years ago, it was the Venice of the Middle East. There were palm trees and beaches. People flew to Basra, Iraq, for their vacations. And now, like, all the palm tree forests are gone. There's no infrastructure. The buildings are, you know, have bullet holes and mortar blasts. There's no postal system in Iraq. It's been, like, you can't send postage, you have to use DHL courier. Like, it's decimated, and it's partly because of international involvement.
When you were following both Najah and Zahed, what was it like for you actually going to those countries and filming these interactions?
I felt so moved when I saw Najah see family members he hadn't seen for decades. The way they hugged, and the men hugged and kissed one another and just held each other for so long. It was so moving to see. Because they're very free and kind of very open about their emotions, and they've all suffered so much loss. So then, yeah, it was just very moving, and I felt privileged to be able to witness and document that part of his journey, but also to see how his journey is like a million others in Iraq who are missing children, or children missing parents. A million people have gone missing since the conflict started in Iraq in the past several decades. And so Najah, looking for his missing son and wife, is that's one journey out of a million people in Iraq making the same journey. And so that was also very, very humbling and moving.
Given how, you know, how much you film, because documentaries always have a lot of footage, how did the process in terms of constructing the actual story, what to keep in and editing, what to take out, what was that process like?
It was so difficult to whittle this down into one film. There were so many twists and turns in the course of filming with Najah and Zahed over 4 years. Two different times, Najah thought he found his son, and there was even a DNA test done once. And so there was so much story. There was even moving interactions with volunteer soldiers or volunteer militia in Iraq who were just regular Joes and, you know, just volunteering to fight against ISIS up in the north. So we were in the south in Basra and meeting these people who were training in barracks that looked a lot like the prisons that Najah and Zahed were kept in during the Iran-Iraq war. And so we asked if we could film in one of them, and the volunteer militia group said, sure, go ahead. And we started filming there. And then the leader of that group had gone up to Tikrit to fight against ISIS. And the next day, we heard that he was caught in a conflict with ISIS, and he was shot and killed. And so it was just really devastating and heartrending to be just kind of to know this person who had done us a good turn had been hit, and our field manager, our field producer there, our fixer said, you know, this, he was really hurt by it as well, but he said, we lose good men every day. And so that was the thing that I felt very deeply, that people living in Iraq, they're just trying to live a normal life. They're trying to send their kids to school. They're trying to, you know, have a family meals on the weekends, and they have losses. They lose good men every day.
You know, Zahed was a child soldier, and I think that is one aspect that, although it's talked about in the media, it maybe doesn't receive as much coverage as it should in terms of what can be done or what should be done about countries who have these types of fighters. What do you think about that conversation and that part of a lot of countries' histories?
I think you raise another great point. There's a lot of brutality that happens in war, and particularly in the Iran-Iraq war. The Ayatollah Khomeini actually created he was asking for volunteers from children and old men because they needed more men in the army. Can we take another break for a second?
Yeah.
Do you edit this?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just trying to remember the name of it. It was called the Baziji. Okay. The Baziji work. Okay. So, and particularly in the Iran-Iraq war, the Ayatollah Khomeini created the Baziji regiment, which is basically just kids and seniors. And there were over 100,000 boys, young boys, who were in the army as young as 11, 12, 13 years old without proper weapons. And they lost their lives in that war. And so that's another human rights violation that not many people know about that occurred in the Iran-Iraq war. And I'm glad you raised it in our conversation.
For me, I think the unsung hero of the film is the score. When I first started watching it, within the first few seconds of the opening credits, I was really struck by the music that I heard. How much do you work with your composer in terms of setting the mood, setting the tone for the project that you're trying to create?
I work a lot with the composer as well as motion graphics people and the entire team, but it's a special time in the making of a film when you're sitting with a composer and looking at scenes together, and he's noodling around on his keyboard and thinking of these strains or whatever. And I was so happy to be working with Todor Kobakov on this. He's such a beautiful, talented composer and musician, and he was able to commission you'll have to get me an orchestra in Europe. I think it was the Budapest Orchestra. It was an orchestra in Europe, and was able to conduct they do that now. They will conduct via video, and he wrote the score for this live orchestra, and he just captured the nuances of emotion that weren't always expressed in words, and so it was just remarkable to be able to have him score the film.
Whenever you make a documentary, and especially one that has the potential to be very, very political, you know, there's always a discussion about, you know, are we a filmmaker, are we a journalist, what sort of angle do we need to take? For you, as the sort of the teller of the story, how conscious was that thinking in terms of the angle to take, and you know, balancing art and film with the politics that go into that region?
It was an interesting challenge to figure out how much of the historical context and political context could we and should we include in the story. I think I always thought the heart of the story is the human story between Zahid and Najah. But there's so much misconception and also just complete ignorance about our own involvement in that region that I knew we had to tell some of the historical context. So, you know, the editor and I, Eamon O'Connor was the editor I worked with. We worked on how to fold in that historical and political context. And, I mean, I think, you know, people like Najah expressed a lot of some of the kind of his own political views, which were really eloquently put when he said things like, the Soviets and the Americans started a fire and we were the wood in that fire and they just kept fueling the fire and we were the ones getting burnt up. And so, I mean, he said it even more poetically than that, but I think I in terms of some of the political messaging, I left it to Najah and Zahid to make those points.
And I read that an earlier, I think, shorter version of the film got an Emmy nomination and was longlisted for an Oscar.
Yeah, it was shortlisted for an Oscar and Emmy nominated. And the feature also got Grand Jury Prize in San Diego.
Talk about that experience, you know, when you learn that you're up for these types of awards.
It was a complete surprise when the short film got nominated for those awards, because at the time we just thought, oh, it's a short. I was gunning to make the feature, and I didn't really know, you know, if anyone would see the short at all. But New York Times OpDocs commissioned it, and hundreds of thousands of people viewed it, and it got nominated. And then it was interesting because there is a whole other level of film campaigning that happens if you're shortlisted or nominated for an Oscar. Then it was enlightening to see that, just, you know, the kinds of screenings that people are organizing to try and get Academy members out to see the film, all this campaigning that goes on prior to the Oscars. It's kind of like a political campaign. It was eye-opening. Yeah.
Well, the film is My Enemy, My Brother, and it's playing now in Vancouver, I believe, until March the 16th?
So it's at Carlton Cinemas in Toronto until March the 16th, and it's playing in Vancouver in April, and it'll be coming to Montreal as well.
All right. It's a very brave, very bold, very powerful film. Anne Chin, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Dan. It was great to be talking with you.
Enjoy the rest of South by Southwest.
Thanks.
All right, cheers.
I'll have some kimchi fries and tell you about it.
That was Anne Chin, the director of My Enemy, My Brother, and it's playing now at the Carlton Cinema until March 16th. This is the Discarded with their song Toxic Reasons off the album Manifesto.
Yeah.
That was The Discarded with the song Toxic Reasons off their new album Manifesto. The Discarded is a Toronto punk rock band made up of Joel Wasson and his sons Jared and Caden. But how did it all start? They only formed in 2016, and Manifesto is already their second album. They had a hometown record release show on February 24th at Duggan's, and are currently doing a mini tour with Peterborough tomorrow, Niagara Falls on Friday, Toronto on Saturday, and then next week in Guelph, Hamilton, and then the 29th in Orangeville. They released their first album in February of 2016, 1 year after forming, and the music is very much rooted in Ramones, Cramps, the very sort of 70s punk rock. 1 year later, they went back into the studio and recorded their follow-up, Manifesto. I spoke with the family trio that is The Discarded, and talked about their unique situation. They all live together, obviously being father and sons and brothers. They write together all the time. They have a practice studio in the basement. But the actual putting it all together and going out there and performing as a family, what is that like for them? So this is my conversation with Joel, Jared, and Caden of The Discarded. All right, I've got Joel and Caden and Jared from The Discarded. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you guys doing today?
Well, we just finished jamming downstairs, and now we're upstairs doing a little bit of a phone interview. We're doing great.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. So you guys fascinate me. I mean, you only came together as a musical entity last year, but obviously
2 years ago now.
Yeah, 2016, right? Late 2016. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But obviously you know each other quite a bit better than that. Where did
we know each other a bit?
where did the idea to take the family unit and your love of music and put it into a creative outlet? Where did that start?
Well, there's always a jamming stuff at my house. Like, we always had drums set up, we had amps, we had PAs, and all that sort of thing. We used to go down and do, like, little fun jams and that, but you got to be kind of a certain age before you can get your hands around a guitar properly. Caden used to bash on a little drum set I'd bought him for a long time. But about 2 years ago, I guess, we've been doing these fun little jams every few weeks or so, and a friend of mine had a birthday party and kind of went, hey, you want to play with your band? Well, I had a member of my band who couldn't make it, so I said, well, maybe can I come and do something with my kids? She went, yeah, sure, it'd be cool. So that was like a gig. We were like, geez, we better learn five songs or so, right? So that's how we kind of came together. And once we did that, we got such a good reaction, and it was so much fun, we thought, well, why don't we try this and do it, have a bit of a go.
It's the band has a very sort of classic 70s punk rock sound. I know why I like punk rock, and I know why a lot of people like punk rock. Why do the three of you like that style of music?
Firstly, I love it. First aggression. You got tons of hard hitting songs without even going into hardcore punk. Just like the Ramones, the Sex Pistols. The early Clash stuff was also pretty heavy. Not saying the later stuff wasn't either, but just the earlier stuff was a bit more punk. But another thing I love about punk is that it can be surprisingly diverse. Like, speaking of the Clash, they really diversified. They went into sort of like reggae and dub overtones in the later albums. So we did. I guess when we started, Caden learned to actually play along to Cramps' album, Bad Music for Bad People. So we had that really sort of boom, whack, boom, whack sort of drum sound when we just started out. I played in punk bands. I was a drummer in punk bands, and that was just sort of the songs I brought to them were very basic garage rock sounds, the ones off of the first album. So that's just the sound that sort of came out and developed there with us.
And they've always been listening to that sort of stuff as well as coming up. Like, I played punk rock stuff, and I had Stiff Little Fingers, and I was into, you know, the Super Suckers, and that was sort of stuff that they heard all the way up through. So it wasn't this guitar punk rock sort of sound. They didn't actually realize that that wasn't popular or mainstream music.
I love the color scheme that you have guys going on, the red and the black. How long did it take for you guys to find that look?
Well, we had this show where we were opening for the Sonics at the Danforth Music Hall, and we thought, oh, that's a pretty big stage. It was like these guys' sixth show ever, and I went, well, we might as well, let's have a little distinguishing look. Most people think, you know, a punk band, you got to be wearing your jeans and a ripped T-shirt and whatever, and all that sort of stuff. And we thought, let's go exactly the opposite. Let's wear, like, thin ties, and let's look like Kraftwerk or a new wave band or something like that, and play some real aggressive punk rock over top of it.
It was black and white originally, wasn't it?
Yeah, we had a couple of different colors. We had black and white, and then we had red and white, and we got some dark purple and black ties as well, and we got a black set of shirts. So we were just kind of switch them up each kind of thing and just kind of come out that way. But the red and the black one, I think, looked kind of stood out the most and had the coolest color scheme. And so when we were putting the album together, we thought, hey, let's wear those for the cover, and that would be the overall scheme and what it would look like visually as well.
In a way, it sort of reminds me of Green Day from their American Idiot days. Was that an influence at all?
Well, we like Green Day. We went to see them last August. Me and Caden got right down front. Caden's a pretty big fan. They write some good songs. You really loved American Idiot when it came out.
Yeah,
that was about 6 or 7 years old.
That was my album of the year.
Yeah, and that was when he was about 6 or 7 years old. He loved Green Day for, like, that kind of period of time. So, yeah, definitely if there's an influence. I don't think we decided, like, I think the kind of skinny ties and red shirts kind of harkened back to more, like, early punk rock is what we're kind of going for, or even almost new wave sort of stuff. Yeah.
Jared and Caden, how do you enjoy going out and playing live with your dad?
All right, I guess. Okay, that's an understatement. I absolutely love it. It's probably the most fun thing I do right now in my life. I live for it, basically. Caden?
I enjoy playing live. I don't really care if I'm playing with my dad or not. I just like, playing a good show. Playing people I'm playing with, yes, I'm related to them, but I don't know. I just try to play with them like they're my band members and have fun.
That is kind of a big thing. It's not like when I'm playing them, they're kind of my peers at that time. When we're writing songs, they're like my peers at that point. Sure, I'm their dad, and there's times when I'm their dad staying in the house or when we're living together. But when we're playing a band, it's like if you played in a band, maybe you have, it's kind of a all-for-one sort of thing, and you play together. And if I wasn't, you know, rocking out and doing it at the level it should have been or should be, or if, even though Caden's 15, if he wasn't rocking out the way that, you know, there's no expectation that he'd be treated like a kid or Jared would be treated like a kid.
There are you know, bandmates who are families and siblings who get along great, and then there are others that hardly talk at all, like Oasis. Creatively, yeah. What's the relationship like between the three of you?
Like you said there, when you've got a band like Oasis, when you're close to someone, you can also be a lot crueler to them a lot faster. You've just got a whole history of, you know, that you're going to smack your brother or someone like that. You're going to, like, have those sort of little sibling fights. Whereas with someone you don't know, you got to be a bit more polite, or they're just going to say, you know, screw you, I'm out of here, right? So, you know, creatively, though, at the beginning, it was kind of just me going, here's the songs. But now it's all of us. Like, our latest songs have all been written together, down in the room, jamming on a riff, and Jarrett may come up with a riff, or I might come up with a riff, or I have a song or a structure, or Jarrett might have it, but Caden adds a lot by just us riffing off his drum beat.
And the most recent song example?
Yeah.
The most recent song, Dad had the lyrics originally before the music was even written, and he hadn't come down yet to the jam session, so me and Caden were just jamming, and he did a drum beat, and then I literally just made up a bass line on the spot, and that became the basis for the whole song.
me and Gabe basically wrote the music. Dad had the lyrics. They fit the two together, and it works perfectly. So creatively, whoever brings what is what we kind of go with there. There are sometimes I might be bringing something in, go, look, I've written a whole song. But more so of late, it's kind of nice to play off of the drums and rock off of what he's laying down there. And at the beginning, when Caden was new, I'd go, okay, here's a drum beat. But now he finds his own way and develops some really cool stuff for us.
You know, Manifesto's your second album since 2016, and that's pretty prolific for any band. Do you think the fact that you guys are always together helps you in terms of how quickly you're able to get material out?
Yeah, for sure. We all live together, so it's like, you know, it's not like you got to go to a practice space. We practice down, like, we have a room finished in the basement where those guys share, and that's where the instruments are, and that's where we jam. And it's sort of like, hey, we're having dinner. It would be if we were at some place where you had to go somewhere to jam, it would be like, okay, I got to be there at 7 o'clock. I got to travel there. Us, it's just like, okay, we're at 7. Well, let's make it 7:30, right? And then you just kind of go downstairs, you turn on, and you go. Even so, it's funny enough, we're doing this tour. We're doing like 10 shows in a month. And what have we been doing? We've been kind of writing a lot of new songs because we're excited about playing live, and then that gets the creative juices going. And so we're about an album usually ahead of what we've been recording, just because I got a lot of songs that I've had before, and we're writing lots of songs still.
The show that you guys are doing on Friday here in Toronto is at Duffy's, and I know it's all ages. Is that something that is important for you guys? Joel, you can probably speak to this, is that it harkens back to the early days of punk with the shows at like CBGB and stuff, where it was always all ages.
I love all ages. Actually, the show's on Saturday. I don't think that one is all ages, if you want the truth.
Unfortunately.
We love playing all ages shows, and I think we're doing about three or four of them this tour. We did our opening show at Duggan's. We did it about a couple of weeks ago. That was an all ages. And we absolutely love doing all ages shows. I really think it's important to get back to having people be able to come out of all ages and be able to listen to music, right? We're also doing one in Hamilton. It's an all ages show. We're doing another one in Orangeville at the end of this tour. It's an all ages show.
Yep.
So we got, I think, four of them on this tour in total. I love the all ages thing.
What do you think about the fact that there's not necessarily as many opportunities for young people to see the types of shows that you guys are putting on? That, if you know, most of the shows that young people go to are big stadium shows,
yeah,
and then there's not a lot of venues that are smaller.
Absolutely. I remember when I was younger, you could go to all ages shows. There was a lot more all ages shows for people to go out and see bands. And now, you're right, someone who's young thinks, I can only go see this huge mega concert sort of thing. And half the time, those aren't really that real, because it's more of a light show and pyrotechnics and dance routine with some music thrown in, right? As opposed to seeing guys up front, inches away, sweating away, playing for you, actually playing their instruments, right? Which we're finding that young kids that come out, you know, sometimes it's just like their parents going, hey, you know, come along. They got a couple of young kids in the band. And then afterwards, they're just like, that was really cool, man. That was like, you know, when's their next show? We'd love to go see them, sort of thing. So I really think that needs to happen a lot. I guess a lot of the time these venues become alcohol salesmen. So that's why they got bands in there. But really, that model's kind of failing with clubs closing because of that.
I can personally speak as someone who just came of age recently for drinking. I was always annoyed that I couldn't get into the clubs because I just wanted to see the bands. I didn't want to drink, but because I couldn't drink, I couldn't see the bands.
Yeah. So it would be cool, like something like Europe, where they go, there's alcohol, and you can put an X on the person's hand, and they can be there, and it's not a big deal just to go for the actual music watching part, you know?
How do you, Joel? How would you rate your kids' sort of stage presence and interactions with the audience throughout the show?
Caden just said 10, but
you hog the mic too much.
Well, I'm the only one with a mic. You can go up and talk all you want, buddy.
You usually give me a mic, but you never give me a word.
Well, I gave you a word. Okay, oh, we're having a band squabble here. Okay, just one moment, please. I have to pound on someone. I'm just kidding. Actually, Jared has a great stage presence, and that comes back quite a bit. People really say that, and Caden as well. Like, it's very important that they see them as opposed to the old guy. And so it's kind of cool that they're up there. It's, you know, to me, when we played our sixth show and it was in the Danforth Music Hall and we came off the stage, I'm like, there's going to be nothing that's more nerve-wracking than that. So after that particular point, I think they really grew, and it was just like, yeah, we can get up and play in front of five people, or we can get up and play in front of 500, and we're going to give it just as much. And they've been actually, that's what's been really, really amazing. And it makes me a proud dad to watch them go up and go, man, these guys kick it. They're damn shit-hot rhythm section.
Yeah, my presence is just by overdriving my amp and being really loud.
You move around more now, too, because I am
fair enough.
For a month,
I don't,
Mike.
I don't talk with fans at all. I like to keep the air mystique. I don't talk to anyone before the shows. I just mind my own business and then I play.
Yeah, but you go out to the merch table afterwards and say hello. It's just like you're 15 and you don't have a lot to say. It is important that we interact in that, like... You know, we go out afterwards, you stand at the merch table, we'll sign anything you want, we'll chat with anyone, but you even said it was kind of funny, your longest conversation is, well, good drums, thanks. How old are you? 15. Awkward silence.
But no, we love interacting with fans, new, and we even have a few long-time fans now.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
I love it.
So answer your question, they're pretty good on stage, they're pretty damn hot.
Thank you.
Jared and Kaden, how much have you learned about the business side of the music industry in the last couple of years since you started doing this?
Nothing. No, what are you talking about? I've learned quite a bit, and there's obviously still lots to learn, but I've really seen a lot of how you got to be professional, you got to learn how to set up quickly, sound check, and just stick to a schedule, and just really professionalism.
We have a lot about, I explain as we go along what the sort of process is. Hey, we got this happening here. We're doing this recording. The recording costs this much. It costs this much to make an album. This is where the album goes out. This is how it kind of works. Like the whole DIY sort of thing they've been involved in. So I think absorb a lot more than they actually understand or take credit for, like, you know, getting up on stage, being able to do a sound check, packing up, making sure that you all work together as a band, make sure everything gets moved, everything gets set up, you know, like, and just to stay real, you know, like, you know, people get such big heads. A lot of what's kind of cool is just kind of, what's good about being a band is making the music part of it. That's the funnest part. That's the best part of being in a band.
That's the most fun part.
Which is what we try to keep it down to. As us, it's just like, okay, there's all this other stuff you need to do in the music industry and such. But the funnest part is why we do it is because we make music and we really like making music.
If we could break even, that'd be great.
Yeah.
How much do you think about the long-term future? You know, as the boys grow up, they may want to go off and do their own thing. Is Joel, is that something that you think about at all, or are you just sort of taking it, you know, day by day, moment by moment?
They go off, they do it, right? We you know, like, people go off and play whatever, you know, if it gets to that point where they get in some other band and they get way bigger and that's what they're spending their time with, but I know people who play in that band and come back. We've got a thing right now, it's sort of like we got a cool unit that's going together, we're making music. So until that either gets stale or they just, you know, go off to something else, that happens. Unlike, you know, no different than any other band. To me, I've got probably a more realistic sort of standpoint about the whole thing. I would be proud of them just that they, you know, we did this together and we went off and did it. And if they went off and did that, maybe they'll just come back and do the odd gig here and there. But right now, this is our main band and what we're doing. And
we're for sure looking towards a third album, probably a fourth as well.
Right. So, you know, play it as it goes and you can't, you know, que sera, sera when it goes off the rails or it's no fun anymore or people want to move on, then you got to look at each other and do that. And maybe we'll just get together and make some noise down in the basement every so often.
From each of you, would you say you have a favorite track off of Manifesto?
Ooh, if you have one, give me a second to think because I have a lot of favorites.
Oh, you get a lot of favorites. Okay. I think being the first one off it, Toxic Reasons is a really good indication of what we're at and what our sound is. You know, you got the punk rock guitar with a big, wide, distorted sort of sounding there. You got a more intricate bass line going on. You got Caden just chugging the drums along there. So really, I think that really gives a good indication of our songwriting and our playing together as a band.
I personally quite like I Don't Know What to Believe, just sort of the loud, soft dynamics, the more sort of groovy bass line and guitar in it. that's probably going to be my favorite. And plus, live, it's the song I get to sing backing vocals on. Yeah, Caden? Yep.
I like We Resist. I think the drum part is different and cool. I get to do some different things on there that I don't usually do in other songs.
Yeah, and I think,
You know, bass line's pretty cool. And that's about it.
Yeah, that was my over-ambitious one. Yeah, we actually we're quite proud of what we did on this album and what Ian Flirton got as a recording there. We thought it was a, you know, at the end of it all, we went, wow, that really captures what we sound like. It was done pretty live off the floor for all the bed tracks, and they did the singing afterwards. So we think it's a really good indication of what we sound like right at this moment.
Well, the new album is Manifesto. You're Thursday at the Red Dog in Peterborough, Friday at the Geekery in Niagara, Duffy's on Saturday here in Toronto, and then next week in Guelph, Hamilton, and Orangeville. Joel, Jared, and Caden, thanks so much for jumping on the phone tonight, guys.
Oh, damn, thanks a lot for chatting with you. It was a good chat.
No worries. Maybe I'll see you guys on Saturday.
Oh, yeah, you coming out? That'd be great.
All right, yeah. We'll see you then.
Say hello if you do.
Yeah, for sure. All right, take care, guys. Right. Ciao.
Take care.
Yep, bye.
That was my conversation with Joel, Jared, and Caden Wesson of The Discarded, taking you out with their song, I Don't Know What to Believe, off Manifesto. Thanks for tuning in. I will see you next time. Bye for now.
Black or white? Who says I gotta join your fight? I believe there are shades of gray. More I believe the things that you say. My opinion you're trying to sway. Sound